Jackie and I have both had opportunities to work in settlement houses. And I've worked in for a national organization which advocates for the development and the programming of settlement houses, as well as for a settlement house. And we've talked several times about some of the mutual experiences that we've had, or complementary experiences that we've had. But as we were talking about it the last couple of days, more to my mind comes the fact that the settlement movement is a movement in history, and it's far more interesting in history than it is in contemporary life, that it really doesn't have the activity, it doesn't have the momentum that was seen at the height of immigration, which was a time that settlement movement really came to be in America. The first settlement house was Toynbee Hall in London, on the east end of London, close to Oxford and Cambridge. It served as a training ground for Cambridge and Oxford students to get some real life experience with real problems, poor people and hunger and housing and labor and the like. That was, the first one was settled probably about 1860 to 1880, and then it came over to America. I think Jane Addams, our little history, indicated it was 1889 that she built Hull House, or didn't build, a woman, Helen Culver, donated the house, and they moved into it in Chicago. The idea really caught on. Jane Addams was a real promoter. She had a lot of energy, and she went around the country with her movement. Boston and New York really got interested in, out of necessity, again, because there was a lot of immigrants coming to the United States, to the harbor towns of Boston and New York, and it was necessary that they be greeted by somebody, that they learn English, that they learn some skills, that they learn how to apply their skills, what the American market was like. And that was one of the primary reasons that the settlement houses began, as well as residents.
I guess I'd like to differ a little with something that Carla said. And I think there are some exciting things that are happening now locally in settlements. But I also agree with part of what she said, because I think when anything that starts as a movement switches into being institutionalized, something changes. And I think that is part of what has happened with settlements. And I think also in social history, there's always a tension between, particularly in social services, between providing direct services, meeting human needs, and then the social activism. And I think those things are always held in tension. More about Jane Addams. She's sort of a foremother to this entire movement. She also, she was very instrumental in taking local issues that she worked with in Chicago and bringing them to a national level. Things like instituting child labor laws. She was very instrumental in that. She started the Women's International League for Peace and Freedom. She also was a Nobel Prize winner in the 30s. So she has a very illustrious history.
When did she die?
I'm not sure. No, 1930 something. I don't know.
20th 40s. Century.
But
I'll look it up.
It's right here in the
1935.
Yeah. Let's see.
The Peace Prize in 31, so that was one.
I would also like to read a little quote here. Carla was talking about where the social settlement movement started in Toynbee Hall in London. And this is a paper that was written about Toynbee Hall, and it's talking about the subjective necessity for social settlements. And one of the things that was really critical in the beginning social settlement movement was the fact that it was not only for poor people, working class people, immigrants, but that it also provided something for the upper class people that were working in the social settlements. So I'd like to read this quote. "This paper is an attempt to analyze the motives which underlie a movement based not only upon conviction, but upon genuine emotion, whenever educated young people are seeking an outlet for that sentiment of universal brotherhood, which the best spirit of our times is forcing from an emotion into a motive, these young people accomplish little toward the solution of this social problem and bear the brunt of being cultivated into unnourished, oversensitive lives. They have been shut off from the common labor by which they live, which is a great source of moral and physical health. They feel a fatal want of harmony between their theory and their lives, a lack of coordination between thought and action. And I think in a sense that's true today. These young men and women long to socialize their democracy, are animated by certain hopes which may be thus loosely formulated, that if in a democratic country nothing can be permanently achieved save through the masses of the people, it will be impossible to establish a higher political life than the people themselves crave, that it is difficult to see how the notion of a higher civic life can be fostered save through the common intercourse that the blessings which we associate with a life of refinement can be made universal. So I think that's another key part of what social settlements were about, and that is participatory democracy.
Right. I'm not going to disagree with you, Jackie. I guess some of the other characters that I really have been inspired by who were active at that point in history, I'd like to just mention. One was a congresswoman from Montana. Her name is Jeanette Rankin. She was women in Montana got the right to vote in 1914, and she was elected to Congress in 1917 and had the opportunity to vote with 49 other members of Congress against U.S. entrance into World War I. She went on in her political career. She was a convicted pacifist through that time. Women's suffrage had a close identification with the settlement movement in terms of some of its specific programs that it supported: health care, labor laws, pacifism, I guess other welfare and education issues in general. She was elected later on to Congress from Montana. I'm not sure if she was on the Progressive Party or the Democratic Party, and at that time had the opportunity to serve when the U.S. was voting whether or not to go into World War II. She stood alone. There was no other member of Congress who would vote with her against entry into World War II, and that pretty much took care of her political career as far as an elected official. She did not cease to be very involved. In fact, at the age of 87, she was leading protests against Vietnam. She died when she was in her 90s on a farm which she'd established for women, a cooperative farm in Georgia, where she was activating a lot of social settlement kinds of programs on the farm, training people living in community and using that as a base for her political ends. A fellow by the name of Jacob Riis, or Riss, R-I-I-S, who was a Dutchman, immigrated to the U.S. when he was in his early 20s. He was a photographer and reporter. And at that particular time in history, the flash bulb had just been invented. He took advantage of that to expose the conditions in tenement houses and in poor neighborhoods in New York and shocked America. I can't believe people live like that. The title of his book was How the Other Half Lives, and it's a pictorial history of poverty on the Lower East Side.
About what time is that?
He lived from 1849 to 1914, and his book, How the Other Half Lives, was published about 1910. And he was very well. He was very well read. He exposed infant mortality and a lot of other related health issues to the social. I guess kept the bandwagon going. There was a lot of action going on the Lower East Side in New York, which is where the settlement that I worked at in New York is located, and the neighborhood. Probably hasn't, in some ways has changed a great deal, and then in other ways perhaps probably hasn't since the time of the settlements. The settlements are no longer residences as they were in the past. Housing is a bigger issue than ever now that some of the concerns that social activists have been is in tenants' rights and improving housing conditions, which has meant that a lot of poor people have had to be relocated. They can no longer occupy some of the buildings that are condemned, which in the past they had occupied, and have been relocated or dislocated because there's no more improved place for them to move into. So there have been two sides of the housing issue, and people do continue to occupy warehouses and buildings that have been condemned, and they occupy them very illegally. Another woman that I would just like to mention, and we had a night with Pat that we talked about women who influenced history, and the name Margaret Sanger came up. She was a woman, a nurse on the Lower East Side, and she was concerned with maternal child issues, was a birth control advocate, was put in jail because of her advocacy of birth control. The stories that I hear, she was standing on the dock greeting the immigrants as they got off the boat and handing the women diaphragms. You know, I don't know. I didn't never saw that in the book, but it was in one of my social work classes. And from the sounds of her, she was kind of a zealous person, and I wouldn't be surprised. Population and poverty, the parallels go way back. A lot of control is exerted on the poor by the majority. In terms of birth control, that's one of the issues that is debated.
And especially, isn't it true if a lot of these women were Roman Catholic, it was not only the cultural stuff, but the church, mm-hmm. I mean, was the
church, right.
Not supporting birth control.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, it was just a radical thing to do. You just don't get involved in people's personal lives or in their religious life, or in the way in which she did. That's all I want to say about those folks. I guess the reason that I say that it's more alive in history is because I guess we know more about history now. Sometimes when we live things, we can't see the result of their work. Having worked on the national level for settlement houses, it's really defeating. You can see more work on the local level when you actually see what's done. When I went and visited, I had six settlement houses where programs were in action, which my agency got the federal funding, and I was then in charge of supervising, administering the program, and making sure they were complying with the goals and objectives and the federal regulations. I was a little bit removed from it, and I saw how politically, the times are not good for the issues that we see on the neighborhood level. We want to help the problems of the unemployed, the problems of the inequities in the educational and the economic system, and we don't see that happening on a national level. And that's where I see that it's easier to see in history things that have already been accomplished, which I'm sure people sweat blood over back then. And Jackie had the opportunity to work more directly with the day-to-day successes.
And failures.
And failures.
I guess I'd like to start by telling you a little bit more about the agency and the neighborhoods that I've worked with. The agency I worked for was Eastside Neighborhood Service, and we worked in both northeast and southeast Minneapolis. Those are two very different neighborhoods, And so oftentimes the priorities would clash, and there was some difficulty with that. Northeast Minneapolis is an Eastern European working class neighborhood in Minneapolis, which in itself is a rarity, if you're familiar with Minneapolis. So that includes, it was Polish, Russian, Ukrainian, Czech. There's also a little Italian section to the neighborhood and a Lebanese community that was part of the neighborhood, which gave it a great, you know, a certain richness. And also a difference. In a sense, the melting pot, they are never melted. I mean, those ethnic groups are still pretty distinct from one another. They each historically had their national church. There was the French Catholic Church, the Irish Catholic Church in this neighborhood, the Polish Catholic Church, Holy Cross. And those are still very strong, though some of them, like the Irish and the Germans and the French, have really moved out of the neighborhood. The churches are still there. But the Polish church is still a very, very strong influence in that neighborhood. And part of the ethic is that people really take care of their own there. And as a result, we were really the only major social service agency in that neighborhood. The Southeast community is the university community in Minneapolis. And so it's much more transient. You have a lot of people in and out, students. And then in the more stable sections of Southeast, Prospect Park was one of those. You have a community of professors and their families, academicians. And then on the border of that was Luxton Park, which was a housing project that we worked in. And we provided services in both those neighborhoods, and they were pretty diverse. Some of the services that we worked on were for the elderly. That included transportation, an adult daycare for the elderly, which is sort of an alternative to a nursing home, a congregate dining program. We had two child daycare centers, two nurseries. The heart of the agency was the family and community workers, the kinds of things that they worked on. We did a lot of group work, things for teenage mothers, groups for family and friends of the mentally ill, children that were in some sort of change. Maybe there had been a divorce or a death in the family. Let's see. We also had a camp in Gordon, Wisconsin. And then my section of the agency was a volunteer department, which there's a certain advantage. People were very specialized, but I was a generalist in the agency, which gave me a certain amount of freedom and meant that I wasn't as tied to working on a specific issue as some other people were. So I was more flexible and could work on some of the needs. The 3 years that I worked in this agency, really, I saw some real changes. By the time I left, we were working much more on basic human needs, meaning food, energy assistance, providing clothing, I mean, unemployment. We're talking, you know, basic human needs that we were trying to meet. Let's see. The other interesting piece about that neighborhood is that, or this organization, is that in its 68-year history, it has only had four directors, which is really pretty amazing. So there's a certain stability to that neighborhood, and people often grow up there and live there your whole life. And so I was clearly an outsider, and by the time I left, people were starting to accept me. But that, you know, that was an interesting kind of experience, too.
How long were you there?
3 years.
Yeah. Is that the job you got to come
to? Mm-hmm. Did you want to talk about the history of volunteerism right now?
Hmm. Well, let's see. Oh. Well, I can say a few things about that. Carla and I were discussing this a little early about the, well, I guess there's a whole voluntary section to the economy, which has a very important impact, and particularly in an agency like this. One of the things that I did before I left was had a woman, a graduate student in history, write a volunteer history of the agency, which was really fascinating, and it ended up being published in the community newspaper, which is part of, I think, the richness of working in a neighborhood-based organization, in that you can really build a sense of history, neighborhood, and community, which is also part, I think, of what churches try to do on a local level. And the volunteers have had a major piece in what has happened in that community. One of the things they did was, Northeast has always felt slighted politically in the city of Minneapolis. They've always felt like they haven't been organized quite enough to have, compared with the other, particularly the south side of Minneapolis, to have the same sort of impact politically. But they have had some major successes. One of the things they did was organize and demand that a high school be built. And so they, I think that was in the 20s, Edison High School was built in the neighborhood because of that. Interestingly enough, that's another thing that I think social settlements do, is that they create things, programs, whatever they are, and then pass them on. So it has that, it can be innovative in that sense. One of the things they also did was organize the ministerial association in the neighborhood.
Give them a cause to band together.
Right. That was in the 60s, and I think they worked a lot on the race issue at the time.
I was just going to say that some of the most interesting work in life is volunteer work. And I think that's what got a lot of people with a lot of energy involved. And it's not that long ago that social workers, teachers, and people who found themselves hanging out in settlement houses started getting paid for what they're doing. I'll never forget one. This wasn't at a settlement house, but this was at a mental health center where I worked, and we had a residence for, it was like a halfway house for mentally ill people, and so in many ways it kind of paralleled some of the features of a settlement house. This one woman came to me, and she had volunteered in other capacities at other agencies, and we just hired her to be a mental health worker. And her job was to counsel people and to take them back and forth to doctor's appointments and to run a group 3 mornings a week. And she says, I can't believe you're paying me to do this. I love this work. And that's what I often think about some of the direct service components of social work. I stop and think what a joy it is for me to be part of vital growth in people in turmoil or people in conflict and to help straighten things out on those times when I am able to help them straighten things out. And I just think it's such a blessing that my jobs have paid me to do that. And I don't know that they'll continue to. I may have to find myself volunteering to do that work in the future, to be enlivened by it. But many people go for the whole middle class high of it.
The other thing that I had happened to me while I was working at Eastside was a woman came in, she was retired, and she wanted to volunteer. And she said that 40 years ago, she had been given her first job by a referral from Eastside, and now it was like 40 years later, she wanted to repay that in some way. So she came back to the agency to volunteer.
I just have a little story kind of on that connection of a woman who worked at Grand Street Settlement. Well, she was a volunteer at the time when I was there. She had grown up with the settlement house, not in the same building that it was in when I was there, but it's still basically the same neighborhood, like the neighborhood that Jackie described. The Lower East Side, north of Delancey Street, didn't change terribly much, for those of you who know New York, in the probably the last 60 years. A lot of housing projects have gone up, but many of the buildings in the neighborhood are 80 to 100 years old. This woman is probably 70 years old today, grew up in the same basic neighborhood, and over the course of the years, went to the camps for Grant Street, had her kids going to school there, became like the grandmother of the agency. Every afternoon she comes in and babysits the kids until their moms get home from work after the time that they're out of school. There was a time when there was money available for people who were doing after-school program kind of child care, and that was nice, and she was probably paid minimum wage to $4 an hour for doing that, but that made no difference to her when the money ceased, because that was really her role for Grand Street to be there. She was a very integral part of the settlement house in terms of our distribution of items. If we got extra money from one project or extra food baskets, we couldn't give to everybody. Graham Esther would be the one who'd tell us who most needed it. She'd be the one to clue us in on who got jobs or who got laid off and who we should provide some extra service for. Absolutely vital, and provided just excellent care for the kids. Maybe we sometimes would have 30 kids running around and no aides or any older kids to help her with the kids, and just did a wonderful job. The continuity is so important. Jackie talks about 3 years being accepted. I have, you know, it's the people who really do well in agencies are ones who make it their life work.
Oh, I guess the other thing I thought about as I was reflecting on my work in the agency was taking one issue and looking at how I tried to approach it from different ways and different means, both trying to do something a little more active and then also the being forced because of the federal program to do something more direct service, which I wasn't real happy with, but. The issue I'm talking about is hunger, and one of the other strengths I think of being in volunteer services is that I was also free to do a lot of cooperative work with other organizations and agencies in the neighborhood. One of the things I did was a Food for Thought program, which was a nutrition program for seniors. We trained senior volunteers in nutrition, and then they could work with other seniors that were living in their homes, because that is often a problem with elderly who are isolated. Then we also planned, this was with the Food Shelf, the community education people, and the Minnesota Hunger Action Coalition, which is out of the Minnesota Church Center, a forum on hunger, the growing pangs. And so that was more educational, but also with a more active component to it. The federal program that we worked with was the cheese distribution, which you have probably heard about, the distribution of the federal food commodities, which I think is real ironic when food stamps are being cut, basic things like that, and then you give people cheese and butter, which does not meet their dietary needs. I mean, the basic kind of food that people need to survive. And the other piece of it is that a lot of it went to senior citizens, and butter and cheese are probably two of the worst things for their diet. I mean, they do not need more cholesterol. But again, you know, the other side of that is the people that came were hungry. I mean, there were a lot of hungry people out there. And we had over 100 volunteers. They organized that program. They distributed the cheese once a month. And I really had very little to do with it. They did that entirely and loved it. So, I mean, it has It has two sides to it. Oh, the other thing that I worked with this past summer was organizing a farmer's market in southeast Minneapolis. And that was a lot of fun. I really enjoyed that. And so that was local farmers that grew the produce and brought it in and sold it directly to the residents of the neighborhood.
That's neat. Well, my work was with kids, and I couldn't think of any really good stories to tell you about the kids because, like I said, I was a little removed from it. The program that I was funded to do was called Delinquency Prevention, and we had 6 settlement houses across the country. I got to travel to places I never would have traveled to otherwise: Davenport, Iowa; Detroit — Hamtramck was a suburb, but it was in Detroit, Michigan — Richmond, Virginia; Rochester, New York; Akron, Ohio; and Lincoln, Nebraska.
Lincoln.
All these places had settlement houses that had a potential delinquent problem. And under the Department of Justice, the Law Enforcement Assistance Association, or Administration
Act,
had an Office of Juvenile Justice and Delinquency Prevention, which was big, big money in about 72. I think it was under Nixon and Mitchell that would take crime off the streets. There were a lot of jokes about where they were going to put it, but anyway, they were going to take it off the streets and they were and put it in the White
in the East.
So I was in on the tail end of that money. It dried up in 1980, the delinquency prevention money. Mm-hmm. And in the last year of that program, I was we still had a — I was trying to think the other day what our budget was. It probably was about $200,000 divided up amongst the 6 settlement houses who were doing delinquency prevention. It was always really interesting when I would come to visit them. I was sort of the Fed, even though I really wasn't a federal employee. I was paid under the federal grant, and so all of the regulations, and people get nervous sometimes when they think a Fed is coming. And the government's very concerned with categories and definitions, and you got to know what a delinquent is, and you have to know what prevention is, so you know if you're preventing delinquency.
That sounds very —
it was pretty
familiar.
Clear to us that if they weren't in trouble and they were kind of growing on a healthy course, that should be good enough. Well, no, because anybody could be growing on a healthy course. You have to demonstrate that the kids are economically disadvantaged, educationally disadvantaged, from a certain minority group that makes them subject or suspect to delinquency, that they live in a certain neighborhood, or they have a certain religion, or they don't have a certain religion. The whole definition game is when I think of the energy that goes into defining problems in creative ways so that they will be fundable, rather than just doing something about the problem, I just get sick. The amount of time that I spent writing grants that weren't funded and trying to justify action, which it was hard to say that it was going to be successful, but yet I knew that those were the terms that were going to be funded. Those — you have to use a certain kind of terminology, and you have to support certain theoretical background. They take this business so seriously in Washington that they print up handbooks and they tell you what to write in your grants. It doesn't matter whether you're really doing them, but you have to use their theories, you have to use their phrases, and you have to state your goals in their ways, or you're not going to be funded. That was a little disheartening, and then particularly when the the whole program dried up anyway. They thought, well, how do you know that you're preventing delinquency if they're not becoming delinquent? You don't have any statistics to base your prevention on. So what good are you? You know, the Boys Club or the YMCA or the YWCA could be doing the same thing, and then they wonder, well, why would we? What are you doing that's any different?
Carla, this sounds very familiar. The United Way in Minneapolis went through a major reorganization of their funding categories. Prior to 2 years ago, they used to fund service areas, which were things like neighborhood development, broad categories. And now they've moved towards funding problem areas, which means that they're not funding preventative programs. Basically, mm-hmm. It's like you have to define a problem and prove that you are mm-hmm. addressing it. And basically, they funded 20, maybe 25 areas, and I think unemployment was down towards the bottom of the list. It was like 22nd or something, which our way of looking at things, unemployment should have been much higher and causes a lot of the other social problems if you look at things economically. So one of the things that our agency, some other agencies did, and the mayor's office in Minneapolis was go to the United Way and lobby to have that changed, to have it made a higher priority.
Mm-hmm.
No.
No. It was still in, still it was number still, one, right?
Yeah, it was still in process when I left, but it didn't look hopeful.
Well, I guess probably not as we know them today.
It started out
being settlement housing.
Historically, yeah.
The organization I worked for was, up until about 1975, called the National Association of Settlements. It was United Neighborhood Centers of America when I worked for it. So it was, but it's essentially, it was the same organization under the same articles of incorporation, which Jane Addams helped to found along with many others. So it's an historical identity. I think what's crucial to it, and Jackie picked up on the point in terms of working with United Way, the settlement houses and neighborhood centers that are from this tradition are very much concerned with the growth of the neighborhood, with the health of the neighborhood. And there are centers that maybe are only concerned with problem areas, like a storefront legal services office may open up for a couple of years, and they may have a lot of other kinds of things going on, like a neighborhood center. But they're just very specific to one cause. And the settlement houses that we're familiar with are the ones that are really multi-purpose social agencies and do work and on the generalities rather than the categories and the specific problems. And yes, have changed their focus, have out of necessity been flexible to the needs of the communities.
The other thing that's happening right now, and I don't know if this bodes well for the future of neighborhood centers or settlement houses in the neighborhoods, but in Minneapolis, two of the large settlements, Northside and Pillsbury Waite, which is on the south side, are merging. And there were initial meetings and all the settlements were invited, but the thing that's happening is that those two are merging, which are two major service areas in Minneapolis, two very different parts of the city. And I think what they're hoping is that because of their size, they will be able to really have a corner on some of the funding for the future. And so I'm not sure how that...
Even though they sort of cease to be neighborhood centers,
yeah,
when they're
a
whole city-wide.
I think that's really critical, because I think that's one of the strengths of what a neighborhood settlement does. I mean, it really works at a local level. So we'll see what happens. The other interesting piece of that is that the McKnight Foundation funded that. So
what is the McKnight Foundation?
It's the 3M Foundation.
Oh.
Yeah, they funded the study that led to the merger. The other thing that happened is that I talked to one of the staff members from Pillsbury Waite, and she said that the staff was really left out of most of the discussions and decisions about that merger, and the north side director was made the director of the merger, and there were some pretty bad feelings about that. So we'll see.
Yeah, the tension in the Settlement House alone, as Jackie described, the different ethnic groups and religious groups, I think of Grand Street being just, it had two main populations, Puerto Rican and Black, and there was a real, there was a tension there, too, in terms of who gets what, who lives where. And then to think of an organization going citywide and mixing all of those different definitions of problems, definition of growth, definition of community service together, it's real hard to. Where I think on a smaller basis you can juggle those things and you can negotiate better.
Do the different minority groups see themselves forced into competition for
scarce
the small amount of resources and federal help and stuff that's available, you know, so that one group, Puerto Ricans, may really resent if some kind of particular funding comes through for, you know, earmarked for Black group something, mm-hmm. and vice versa? Is that part of what creates some of the tension there?
Yeah, the thing where I noticed it is I had a jobs program, and I was able to get more Puerto Ricans jobs because they were bilingual. And a lot of jobs asked for bilingual people, and really they asked for bilingual because they wanted to make sure they could speak English as much as Spanish. But they had an edge on the market because of the language. And that they saw that as being really unfair. So, yeah.
I mean, you know, if they're getting just kind of the leftover piece of the pie, all those mm-hmm. groups, mm-hmm. and then they've got to fight over mm-hmm. who gets what mm-hmm. share of already a very meager piece.
Right, right.
I can't see that would be anything but tense. And really defeating for everybody.
But on the other hand, it's also hopeful, where I sent... There's one job in particular where I sent three people. I referred three people for the job, and one woman was hired who was Puerto Rican and was a high school graduate and bilingual. The other two, it was less easy for them to see it. I guess in general, kind of they felt bad because they didn't get the job, but I don't think that they quite generalize it so much as being a racial thing, as being, at least they were able to see that she got a job, that it is possible, that if it happened to her, then maybe it'll happen to them. So there was hope on the small level, on the neighborhood level, where they at least knew somebody who the potential was there for. And even though, sure, you're hurt, there's hope. And the tension could be, it was very healthy when we were able to say, yeah, that's a racial issue, and we could talk about it.
Carter, Jackie, did any of the groups that you, or settlements that you had contact with, were any of them doing anything with lesbian and gay issues, particularly with youth, and a lot of lesbian and gay youth are being expelled from their homes now and migrating to the cities?
I don't know of any that were doing specific work, having had identified that as a problem. I had two young men that were both gay that we worked with in terms of getting a job, but not for those specific concerns.
I'm not aware of anything that was being done with that in the settlements in Minneapolis, but there were other organizations that were working on those issues.
Yeah, you mentioned it could be more of a general.
Specific. Yeah. And for frosting.
Good. Chocolate. I think that's another part of the beauty of settlements is Jackie and I were talking about some of the programs that we've seen come and go through the doors of the same place, and the house is still standing. Years, the Office of Economic Opportunity was funding a lot of things in the 60s that it doesn't fund anymore. There are some things being funded right now that weren't funded in the past, and they go to places like settlement houses and say, will you sponsor us? Will you give us an office? Will you refer people to us? Will you help us get going? We want to work on a certain problem. A lot of legal services were housed in settlements. What are some of the other things that have kind of come and gone through there? And
the block grant money funded a lot of things that were, and in our agency too, we offered space to a lot of fledgling organizations or other. Talent Search was one of them. That was an educational program looking for young people who came from families where neither parent had gone to college, and so they were encouraging them to, you know, define a career path and seek out some higher education. Hennepin County had an office in our building.
Mm-hmm. Some health outreach programs have had more money in the past for doing outreach to mothers and infants and to aged, and they've used settlement houses. Settlement houses have encouraged them because that means the service is going to be better in the settlement house if you're going to be treating people right there. So
I also worked with a children's folk theater that was a new fledgling organization and, you know, had been around maybe 3 years and watched it sort of develop a board of directors, and then, you know, we just offered supportive services, space and typing and those kinds of things, and then it was built into something that could stand on its own. Well, that got pretty wild sometimes.
I was trying to find a little bit of information in the library here. We have some kind of limited resources. But I checked out a great book. It was published in 1911, hardbound for 50 cents, called The Socialist Movement. It has never been checked out of the Holden Library. I still didn't check it out. I didn't want it. Really, I didn't want to put my name on this clean card. Have anybody think I'm a socialist?
Do you have a social security card?
You're a socialist.
I'm a social worker. That's close enough.
Took out loans to go to school?
Worked in a cooperative? Yeah, you betcha.
What's the communism?
Well.
Would you ever go back into that organization?
I could hardly wait to. Oh, into service, like, I'd love to work at Settlement House like Jackie did. Yeah, I'd love to. They're probably still looking for a replacement for Jackie.
Send a message out from your own home.
Really? I'll write you a reference.
But you're only a psychologist.
That's right. I'm not a social worker, which is also very interesting.
Only. Well, we'll close if you have no more questions.
No,
thank you for coming.
Thank you.